Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy podcast. My name is Bogdan. I am the editor of Rethink Energy, and today I have with me Andris Wantanar, our solar analyst. Hello, Andris.
Hello.
In this episode, we will tackle a couple of our articles from the previous 2 weeks. So Rethink Energy puts out an issue every week where we analyze the latest events in the world of renewable energy. And on today's show, we will talk about an article that Andris wrote 2 weeks ago about how China manufactured 622 gigawatts of solar wafers in 2023, and what does that mean in the context of the industry. And then we're gonna touch on an article that I wrote this week. It's a bit of a general article on the state of the green hydrogen industry here and where it's at the moment. But like I said, first over to you, Andris. Tell us about 622 gigawatts of solar wafers manufactured in China in 2023 alone. That seems huge.
So that's the first interesting thing, is we have new numbers from China, bigger and better than ever before, which is almost tedious at this point. But they're especially big this time. But perhaps more interesting, because they are numbers for polysilicon production, wafer production, cell production, and module production, we actually get to see how those differ. And they differ because of exports, specifically exports of wafers and to a lesser extent cells. And then modules are huge, even bigger than that. So I'll just read out all the numbers and then get to the actual, the description of what happened. So we have 1.43 million tons of polysilicon produced in China, and probably about 80,000 tons imported. At the start of the year, the price was still good, so Western companies were able to supply 8,000 tons a month, as they have for quite a while, into China. In the middle of the year, so much new polysilicon had come online within China that the import basically died, so now it's all domestic. Now, 1.43 million tons is enough for about 530 gigawatts, depending on exactly how thick the wafers are, which is constantly changing, but it's probably 2.7 grams per watt or a bit less now. And that's an increase of 67% from the previous year. Then you've got 622 gigawatts of wafers, which is 67.5% more than the previous year. So up two-thirds. For every three manufactured in 2022, five were manufactured this year. Measured in wattage. And then you've got 545 gigawatts of cells, up 65%, and 499 gigawatts of modules, up 69.3%. And the reason the cell and module figures are a bit lower is because China controls all of the wafer manufacturing in the world. Basically, there's 17 gigawatts roughly in Vietnam, but half of that was only brought online this year, and it's all owned by the big Chinese giants anyway. And then you've got a little bit of solar, like First Solar, that uses cadmium telluride, which is thin film, so it doesn't use wafers, or certainly not silicon wafers anyway. So basically, the 622 gigawatt figure here is almost synonymous with the entire global industry. You just have to add up maybe 8 gigawatts from Vietnam and 12 gigawatts from First Solar, and that gives you 642 gigawatts as the size of the whole industry in terms of how much was made last year. So it's quite nice to just go to the website for the Chinese Ministry of Industry and Information Technology. I'm sure it sounds nicer in Chinese. And you get one number that tells you exactly how big the entire global industry is. And they also even published exact export figures, because, of course, the disparities between those manufacturing numbers in different segments aren't exactly the same, because, you know, it's growing and there's delays when you're exporting versus manufacturing. So they told us that 70.3 gigawatts of wafers were exported, and that tells you exactly how much demand there is abroad from cell manufacturers who need wafers to turn into cells. And there was actually a smaller amount of cells exported, which, of course, is going to foreign module makers, of only 39.3 gigawatts. And that tells you that actually at this point, most outside of China solar manufacturing, it actually includes cells now. It's not just modules. Most of the module manufacturing actually has its own cells, or at least cell production that's outside of China. So that's quite interesting. I actually wasn't expecting that. And then, of course, you got 211 gigawatts of modules, finished modules that were exported.
Okay, so Andris,
yes, I'll let you jump in. Sorry.
Slow down, because you threw a lot of numbers at us. Now, just to clarify, because you mentioned wafers, you mentioned cells, and you mentioned modules. At the end of the day, what ends up getting installed is modules. Is that correct?
Yes. So shall I describe the process
so,
in simple terms?
No. That's not the tangent that I'm trying to get you on. So you mentioned in the article 499 gigawatts of modules manufactured in 2023. Now, put this in context, please. How much of these is going to get exported and how much of this is going to get installed in China?
Okay, so... So there were 499 gigawatts of modules made in China, probably like 100 or more made outside of China. So similar to the wafer figure I was saying. As for where the Chinese modules go, 217 installed in China and 212 exported. So you'll notice that those two numbers don't actually add up to 499, which tells us there's stockpiling going on, which we knew anyway, but it's nice to have some you know, vision of how that is going. Also, of course, the installation figures kind of take a little while to catch up to manufacturing.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a good linking point to the story that I was going to talk about, which is the state of the green hydrogen industry, which obviously solar is a number of years ahead of green hydrogen in terms of development. But I guess the million-dollar question really is how do we get to a point when we can talk about 500 gigawatts of electrolyzers having been manufactured in one particular year? I think we're quite miles away from that today. But I think what I'm personally seeing today in the green hydrogen industry is that even though there's so many people debating it and saying it's never going to make it, it's too expensive, it's too scarce, etc., etc., there's no apparent problem. There's no one single thing that you can pinpoint to and say, okay, this is the big problem with the green hydrogen industry. There's just a lot of regulatory framework, mostly, that still needs to be set in place, right? Those off-takers and producers, so both sides of the coin, need to have a clear, written, you know, black on white regulatory framework they can then tackle and assess and build their businesses according to that, in order to get the advantage of incentives and squeeze everything out of the current policies that the West is coming up to. So I guess, you know, linking back to solar, Andreas, have you seen a similar type of uncertainty in the early days of solar?
Well, I was about 12 when it was the early days, the really early days, like it is with hydrogen. So really, I am seeing that with perovskites. And probably, this sounds a bit like the issue with EVs that's talked about, where it's the chicken and the egg.
Yes.
But of course, hydrogen is on a much bigger scale. The minimum scale of an electrolysis plant is much larger than the minimum scale of whatever you need to do in terms of charging stations and EV sales and so on in that segment. Did we actually say that you went to the did we tell our listeners that you were at the World Electrolysis Congress in Düsseldorf?
Well, I guess we just did.
Yeah. So that's sort of the context. So so I get the impression there's been cancellations or delays in a lot of, well, at least several big hydrogen projects recently. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we see, rather than cancellation, it's more delays. It's you know, the question of final investment decision, right? It's always the question of an investor and a bank. Well, more specifically, a bank signing off a big loan for those, you know, $1 billion projects to actually get the ball rolling in construction. And it's all to do with this, you know, the wider uncertainty. And the truth is really that people are just not ready to take the relevant steps, whether we're talking about off-takers or producers. People are just not ready to take the steps, not because green hydrogen is too expensive or technologies are not available. It's just in order to, obviously, you need subsidy, you need incentives in the early stages of a new industry in order to bring costs down. And then hopefully from that, a sustainable business model will spur. But in order for those people and those companies to actually take full advantage of those incentives, Like I said, yeah, the rules of the game need to be clear, and they're not yet at the moment. Right, the US came up with the IRA. The EU has a similar policy in place. They need a time to actually implement it. They need a time to clarify it, and the companies a time to understand it. And that's sort of the stage where green hydrogen is at. Now, I've went on a tangent, so going back to what you were saying about perovskites.
Yeah, there's a couple of good analogies we can draw here, because I'm looking at your article and you're mentioning like a 20 megawatt hydrogen initiative across Europe. Now, I assume that the ideal scale is on the gigawatt scale, not the 20 megawatt scale, right?
That really depends, because if we want to talk about learning curve in an industry, the way you achieve learning curve is not by venturing into gigawatt territory from the get-go. Is by starting out with a pilot that's maybe 1 or 2 megawatts, and then another pilot that's maybe 20 megawatts, and then you get into the hundreds of megawatts territory, and those quickly add up to gigawatt scale. So there's not a question of, is it a problem that we don't see gigawatt scale projects today? Because I think the way the industry should go is, in order to benefit from learning curve, is with those pilots. So the more of those pilots we see, the better.
Jeez, I just reread this article. I mean, I proofed it yesterday, but whenever I proof something, I immediately forget what I read afterwards. And you're mentioning $40 billion in investment in the Suez Canal Economic Zone in Egypt. I mean, so it does look that like they're looking towards the gigawatt scale, but no one is pretending that they can do that first. They want to do 10 megawatts, 100 megawatts, 1 gigawatt, and so on. Which is actually exactly the same kind of wattage that you see with perovskite factories. They want to do, they start out with 10 megawatts, and that actually exists. Then they go to 150 megawatts, and that also exists nominally, but is maybe not fully activated yet, and they want to build gigawatt scales in the future. Now, there's actually another analogy between this and perovskites, which is that a couple of years ago, I was back in 2021, I wrote my first report on perovskites, and I'm afraid I got rather too overexcited and rather too complacent about the technical challenges. And also, our hydrogen writer at the time, Harry, that you replaced, I think he was probably doing exactly the same thing about hydrogen. And we weren't exactly wrong, but it just is taking a few extra years, because you've got these multiple issues that we're trying to communicate right now, which is you want to be able to invest up to billions of dollars in theory. You need a really solid business case, because and the cost differential is $1 or $2 for gray hydrogen, isn't it? And then $5 for green hydrogen. So it's still huge.
And yeah, probably a lot more than five today, but yeah.
Even we'll seven in our tracking. So it is that the governments do need to put their cards on the table and, you know, really change that up. They have to use subsidies to remove several dollars from the green hydrogen price, and possibly also use carbon taxes to add several dollars to the gray hydrogen price, although maybe that's too painful.
No, I mean, that's the reality of things. I think the US, you know, the IRA is really based on carrots, whereas Europe is really taking the carrots and sticks approach, right, with the emission trading system and the carbon tax.
And when you look at mainstream solar, there actually is an analogy between the situation there and the situation for hydrogen, with its... Another thing we probably should have said more explicitly for our listeners is that you go to the World Electrolysis Congress, there's all these recent announcements about things just being a bit slow and sort of negative coverage. But all of the companies, correct me if I'm wrong, say, well, we don't have any fundamental problem with the technology. So it's really just a matter of investment and industrial scale up, right?
Yeah. If you want to simplify things and... we're simplifying things a touch. There's still some, you know, we're talking about technology. There's still some improvements to be made. There's still some kind of knocks to iron out. But again, we're talking about learning curve. You know, it's to be expected. Like there was, you know, big announcements about Sinopec in China having commissioned the world's largest electrolysis project today, which is a couple hundred megawatts. And they've encountered a few issues. Now, that's exactly what learning curve is, isn't it? You put a project in place, you have a couple of issues, and you learn from them, and the second time you do it better. So, and then hopefully the wider industry can learn from
And the analogy to the modern day mainstream solar industry that I just mentioned and then never described is that the solar manufacturing mainstream is doing fine. It's just grown by 2/3 in 1 year, almost probably for the second year in a row. But there is an exception, which is that that's all Chinese for wafers. We do see non-Chinese cell manufacturing almost doubling based on the wafer export numbers. But with Western attempts to manufacture wafers, they're stalling. The only actual wafer factory that I can remember being announced, I mean, there's probably one from NextWave, but they're using a totally different technology. But the main one was Cubic PV, 10 gigawatts, pretty respectable size, announced in the US. And then they just had to abandon it because it turns out this is the most investment intensive and energy intensive part of the supply chain. And who likes energy intensive and investment intensive? The Chinese. And how do you build something like that in the West? You need the IRA. But when everyone was writing all these subsidies for the IRA, they did it in like 2022, 2023. And they just didn't quite grasp, quite how huge the cost drops would be coming from Chinese modules. And so the subsidies available in the IRA just weren't big enough for Cubic PV's system. Another sort of issue is that the expertise is exclusively Chinese now. So they were building it with a whole bunch of Chinese hires, which I guess there's nothing actually inherently wrong with that, but it just goes to show how there's no learning curve or growth pains anymore for mainstream solar in China. For the West, we did have this hump similar to the hydrogen mega projects, and we did, and we have stumbled on it, and we're now reverting to a strategy of, it looks like we're reshoring a lot of module and cell, but the wafers is still basically China. If we want something that's definitely not coming from forced labor in Xinjiang, well, we can use the residue of Western polysilicon manufacturing, which still comes to like 40 gigawatts if you run it completely. Mm. And then we can send that to the wafer factories in Vietnam that are owned by Chinese giants. And then, and it's a bit sad. It's like we reshored everything a little bit, except for wafers. Just don't think about who owns those wafer factories in Vietnam. And I guess we sort of won.
No, that's true. And it seems like with that example that you mentioned, it seems like there's still parts of the solar industry, even though it's many, many years ahead of the green hydrogen industry, still parts of it that could benefit from the area, like you said, the reshoring of Western manufacturing. I guess the difference between solar and hydrogen is that when you're talking about electrolyzers, you don't have, right, so you have wafers that make cells and they make modules. In hydrogen, you just have the electrolyzer. So,
well, you do need all this physical infrastructure, but I guess that's not quite the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you need the gigafactories to build the electrolyzers, but then they just churn out the electrolyzers, and that's that. It's just one process. You don't have you know, because in solar, you can build the wafers in one country and then export them, and then build up the cells and the modules in another country.
And another thing is that a purchaser of solar modules doesn't necessarily have to care what it is. You put it in sun and it makes electricity. Whereas if you're switching from gray to green, there are qualitative differences in the infrastructure that needs to accommodate that and transport it and maybe even burn it. Isn't that correct? So that's another hump.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely differences in terms of when you choose an electrolyzer for a project, are you dealing with intermittency? Are you going to have to switch your electrolyzer on and off quite often? So that kind of like dictates if you go on the PEM route or the alkaline route.
So there still is that distinction between electrolyzers who are more relatively investment intensive, but maybe not so costly on the per kilowatt hour. So you want them running all the time versus other ones which are cheap to build, but maybe more expensive to run. So you can ramp them up and down as sort of demand response and use excess electricity that costs nothing.
Yeah, sort of, very much that case. You have, the classic, PEM and alkaline leading the line. Banks know those technologies. They've invested in them for a long time now. So they sign off loans for those really easily. But the problem with PEM is you have high costs because they do rely on platinum group metals, and so you have high costs. But they are better at intermittent electricity inputs, right? So that really matches with renewables. But then on the other hand, you have alkaline, which doesn't have any of the rare earth, the platinum group metals, rather. So the costs are lower, but they're not as capable as accommodating intermittency in electricity input. But that's when, you know, technologies like pressurized alkaline, which deals better with intermittency and doesn't have the cost issues, comes into play. And there's also a couple of other technologies and plenty of startups trying to reinvent the wheel, so to say. So there's a couple of differences, but plenty of parallels with solar still.
Especially probably perovskites, because I've written this perovskite report, my second one, that's saying that you'll have gigawatt scale manufacturing from 2026, which would still be only a couple of percent of the total market. And that might turn out to be correct. It might also turn out to be that I was wrong again, and this time certain companies are also embarrassed because they said they would get it started in 2025 and so on. Now, if that happens, what's my conclusion? Well, my conclusion is, well, they'll just have to do it the year after or the year after that, because silicon technology is basically, it's done all of the cost declines and all the efficiency declines that are dramatic. It's a good technology, but no one is going to give up on perovskites, which have a very clear potential to increase the power output per square meter by 50% without that much of a cost increase. And that's just where all the R&D is going to go in an industry of several hundred billion dollars a year. And the same thing applies to hydrogen. You see these disruptive, these delays, and you just say, well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, maybe the schedule changes for the industry, but there's just, what's the alternative to hydrogen? There isn't one if you want to do the full energy transition, so it'll still happen.
And I agree with that. There's plenty of industrial processes which really don't have an alternative. You can then, you know, get into the discussion of blue hydrogen as being the other prominent alternative to green hydrogen. And I was actually talking to someone from Honeywell, a big industrial player. They have fingers in many, many pies, many, many sides of the industrial sector. And they're choosing both blue and green hydrogen. And, you know, I had quite a heart-to-heart chat with one of their people. And he was quite honest and said that, if green hydrogen wins, then they win. If blue hydrogen wins, then they also win. So why shouldn't they chase both? And it makes sense, you know, for players who have the money to invest and to bet on multiple horses, it makes sense for them to do so, even though the demand for blue hydrogen might just be in the short term. I guess, you know, in the context of the global energy transition, which you brought up, we're at a point where every little bit helps. And if green hydrogen is going to take a couple of years to get there, if blue hydrogen can help in the meantime and mitigate some level of emissions, then they're still better than using gray hydrogen.
That actually reminds me of when natural gas was called a transition fuel. And, I'm sure our colleagues Peter and Harry would disagree if they were here to disagree with me. But, you know, they always dislike that because it's still polluting and you want to go to something that doesn't pollute. But there is a positive side of natural gas plants for the renewable energy transition, which is they're very good at being ramped up and down to accommodate a large amount of solar and wind. And they are half as polluting as coal. And maybe with blue hydrogen, you're looking at something similar. At least it's getting there, is it?
Well, yeah, it's steps. But again, if we're talking about in the context of the global energy transition, do we really have time for, 10,000 intermediary steps? Or should we just commit to the greenest option? But again, there are roadblocks to green hydrogen, like we said. Or rather, it will take some time. But I agree with you, there's no real true alternative. Yes, people talk about biofuels and synthetic methane, synthetic gasoline, kerosene, so synthetic fuels, biofuels, e-fuels, whatever you may call them. Yeah, they also have problems, right? Problems scaling up, with problems with cost. The same chicken and egg problem over,
so will
is there demand? Is there supply?
Will it be a bad thing if blue makes a lot of ground? Or will blue actually block green for quite a long time?
Well, the problem with blue is that its price, even though it can undergo learning curve and the carbon capture side of things and the carbon capture and sequestration technology will drop down in price. There's a floor to how low blue hydrogen can drop, because it would always be dependent on the feedstock price, which is natural gas. So blue hydrogen would always be more expensive than natural gas. And we're talking about the potential for green hydrogen to dropping below natural gas, which will never physically be possible for blue hydrogen. So even if blue hydrogen makes ground, even green will come along and drop down in cost, it can undercut it no matter how much ground blue hydrogen is made, because it will have a floor.
All right.
But we'll see how things develop. This is what we do every week. We keep tabs on those technologies and the interplay between them, who wins, who loses, and what the outlook is. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, all of these topics are spurring from articles that we write every week in our weekly issue. You can find these articles on rethinkresearch.biz, that's .biz, and you go under weekly analysis. You can also find our forecasts that I'm sure we mentioned a few of them in our reports under forecasts and data. If you're interested, please do get in touch with us. If you have any questions, we will be glad to answer those. But thank you for joining us today. And we will be back next week at the same time with a couple of new topics to discuss, depending on what we write next week. So keep an eye out for all that. Thank you again for joining, and see you next week. Bye.